Now, let's start this suite of discussions from starting from Dr. Khan's presentation entitled The Aid Policy Network in Pakistan, Actor Network Analysis.
Thank you, Emma. Hello, everyone. The Aid Policy Network in Pakistan, an actor network analysis. This paper is a product of my PhD research work at the University of Bristol. First of all, what is Aid Policy Network? The Aid Policy Network is a complex web of multiple actors involved in the aid delivery system, connected through interdependent relations that define foreign aid policy and priorities for the development sector. The vast aid literature mainly focuses on the evaluation of foreign aid outcomes or aid effectiveness and has rarely considered the practical working of the aid policy process. Specifically, how aid decisions are managed and transformed into action. In that sense, apart from examining aid effectiveness, it is equally important to understand the complex policy networks that influence the aid policy process. This research responds to this gap in the literature. With the aim to study the aid policy network in Pakistan, the objective of this research is to explore donor government interaction in managing the aid policy process in Pakistan. In this context, this research attempts to map the complex aid policy network, determine resource interdependencies, examine actor interaction patterns, and explore actors' perceptions about managing aid policy process in Pakistan. To achieve this, this research takes a policy network approach to explore the complex aid policy network in Pakistan. Adopting Köppingen and Klein actor network analysis, this research will help to understand complexities, interdependencies, and constraints involved in managing foreign aid in Pakistan. Coming to the research methods quickly, a single method approach, namely the semi-structured interviews, was selected to collect primary data from Pakistan. Using a purposive snowball sampling, qualitative interviews were conducted with a range of actors from Pakistan. The data were then transcribed, coded, and analyzed. This is the sample size in Pakistan, and during the 3 months of data collection in Pakistan, during November 2012 and January 2013, the fieldwork was successfully concluded with 43 interviews in total. This is the aid policy network in Pakistan. Using the actor analysis, this research determines who the important actors are. We have identified 9 strategic groups of actors in Pakistan. Mainly, if you look at, there are, can you leave the light? Can you follow this? Okay, so this is the first group is the federal government. The second group is the provincial government. Then we have multilateral donors. We have 2 groups of bilateral donors. One group of bilateral donors comprised of DAC member countries, and the second group of bilateral donors comprised of non-DAC countries. Then comes an external interest group, which is where? Here. It mainly comprised of international NGOs and international research and development foundations. And then we have a domestic interest groups here, which mainly comprised of local partners, which are NGOs and civil society organizations, political parties and other political interest groups. And then we have independent groups. They are not as independent as the name suggests, but they are independent. I was not getting any other name. This includes the bureaucracy and former actors and the media and, you know, think tanks like this. And we also have another group, which is the international forums. This includes the United Nations and the OECD and like this. In the figure, if you see, in the sixth circle, these are the key actors. In the second circle, there are the important actors. And outside this circle, there are the peripheral actors. And they are positioned according to the respondents' views about actors' possession of resources or means, policy influence, and involvement in the development process. In recent years, the aid architecture has transformed in Pakistan as a result of provincial devolution of 2011. Although the transfer of power and resources to the lower level may improve governance, bring greater accountability, and result in effective service delivery, the findings for Pakistan indicate that it further complicates the system. This would lead to extensive engagements with numerous actors, capacity constraints at the lower tiers, readjustments of coordination and collaboration practices, and higher transaction costs. More interestingly, at present, four different political parties have governments in four provinces of Pakistan. Each province, led by a different political party or alliance, thus has different political manifestos and development priorities. Coming to the interdependencies in aid relationships, mutual dependence is a central assumption in the policy network approach. Actors are mutually dependent for their goals achievement, and they cannot achieve their objectives without resources that are possessed by others. This is the analysis we did. If you see, If you see, there are actors on this side, and then there are important resources they carry. It could be financial resource or production resource, competencies or knowledge, whatever. And then there is a degree of substitutability within the network. It could be low or high. And then there is a dependence according to the resource substitutability in the network. According to the analysis suggests that major official donors and the Pakistan government are the critical actors of the aid policy network. Now, why? Because major donors carry large volumes of funds, better quality of technical expertise, and global evidence-based knowledge resource, while the Pakistan government carries important resources such as competencies, legitimacy, and domestic knowledge. These resources, which I just mentioned, are non or less substitutable in the network, which leads to high degree of interdependence and influence in strategic interactions in Pakistan. Coming to the interaction patterns of actors, the network analysis helps to make judgments about the level of inclusivity and the quality of aid relationships in network settings. To explore this, I pick the key actors only and examine their interaction patterns in Pakistan. This is how the patterns look like. In the figure, the thickness of bar, like they are, they are more thick here than here. The thickness of bar indicate frequency of interactions that also reflect the level of inclusivity and information transfer between network actors. If you see here, we have important actor, which is Ministry of Finance, and then we have the World Bank, and then we have the politicians in power, which are mostly the ministers and the chief executives and others. Coming to the Ministry of Finance, they stay in frequent contact with the World Bank, IMF, Asian Development Bank, and politicians in power. Similarly, for the politician in power, they stay in regular contact with the Ministry of Finance and the Planning Department, while the World Bank stays in regular contact with the Ministry of Finance, Economic Affairs Division, and IMF. And interestingly, all have less frequent or rare interaction with local partners and think tanks here. So if you see, they have a rare interaction with local NGOs, here. Finally, talking about the constraints in managing the aid policy process in Pakistan, the discussion inferred that supply-driven foreign aid, capacity shortages in the public sector, and governance issues were the greatest concern for the majority of respondents within the aid policy network. The analysis of these perceptions according to the network group shows that supply-driven aid was the prime concern of actors mostly at the recipient end. Public sector capacity was the prime concern for the donor community, while it was a secondary concern for the government and some former actors, and governance issues were the secondary concern of the majority. Conclusions. Number one, carrying a non or less substitutable resource such as large volume of funds does not guarantee an influential role in the aid policy network. For instance, despite being the largest official bilateral donor to Pakistan, China was not considered as influential actor as other major bilateral donors. This was perhaps due to the limited involvement of Chinese officials in policy forums and public policy debates concerning MDGs and restricted communications with other development partners. Similarly, in strategic bilateral relations, Asian and Gulf bilateral donors were considered to be more trustworthy development partners than US aid and other Western bilateral donors. This perception of the respondents was widely based on the trade and economic sanctions Pakistan faced in the past at the hand of Western donors. Second, the large-scale provincial devolution has made the aid delivery system in Pakistan even more fragmented and complex, operating at multiple levels. Finally, donors tend to be proactive, and aid seems to be supply-driven in Pakistan, partly due to the absence of an inclusive development policy framework and limited capacity of the state. This provides opportunities for donors to dominate the policy debate and pursue their own priorities. Last but not least, this research is suggesting two recommendations. A, to make the aid delivery system work better, an enlightened donor approach based on more demand-driven economic and technical assistance is required. An indigenous version of the foundation model could make development aid effort more productive under the provincial devolution and localization of SDGs. Nevertheless, the federal and provincial government, especially after the devolution of 2011, the federal and provincial governments need to work on formulating policy frameworks under their respective development agendas and to build public sector capacity in a bid to make aid efforts more productive in Pakistan. Thank you.
Anyway, sorry about that. I'd like to express my thanks to the organizers for giving me an opportunity to present my paper on foreign aid and middle-income trap. This research received funding from the Sumitomo Foundation under its grant for Japan-related research projects. Middle-income trap is a phenomenon where a country's economy stagnates after graduating to middle-income status. The inability to move from a low-cost to a high-value economy after graduating to middle-income status is caused by four interrelated traps: economic, financial, institutional, and sustainability. As of 2016, there are 104 countries classified as middle-income compared to 31 countries with low-income status. There's a graph that I want to show, but the graph shows that official development assistance to MICs or middle income countries has remained more or less the same, while total ODA has increased quite significantly from 2007. So where does the additional ODA allotments go? To low income countries. The graph indicates a trade-off between ODA allotted to low income and middle income countries. And at least from 2007, donors have chosen to allocate more ODA to the former. This trade-off is often a logical outcome of what is called need efficiency dilemma that donors face when they decide where to allocate their scarce resources. The huge volume of aid allotment to low-income countries is understandable, but donors should balance their aid allotments to low-income and middle-income countries because, one, middle-income countries face not only traps but also gaps in development. These include persistence of poverty and infrastructure deficit. According to one study, the majority of global poverty at $1.25 or $2 a day is now located in middle-income countries. Financial conditions of MICs vary immensely. Some have adequate source of funding to address poverty, while some do not. Two, middle-income countries generally have a more established political and economic institutions. Better institutions mean better aid implementation and development outcome, and thus more value for money. Three, foreign aid can be redirected towards addressing the so-called middle-income trap, particularly economic and institutional traps. Finally, middle-income countries are not just recipients of aid. They also perform an important role in aid delivery to low-income countries through partnership with traditional donors. My paper seeks to examine how middle-income countries can maximize development outcomes from foreign aid by looking at Japan's and South Korea's experience. In particular, I reviewed two World Bank-funded agricultural projects in Japan and one Japan-funded investment in South Korea. So why these projects? For one, increased agricultural productivity is welfare-enhancing. So as I've said, these projects were chosen because increased agricultural productivity is welfare enhancing and poverty alleviating. It generates jobs for rural poor and addresses food insecurity. South Korea is an excellent model of successful post-war industrialization. Its experience in the establishment of Pohang Iron and Steel, or POSCO, clearly exemplifies that comparative advantage in economies of scale and experience can be acquired over time. These cases provide valuable lessons to middle-income countries in responding to economic trap. I argue that the catalytic role of aid to MICs is optimized when it is oriented to addressing the traps and gaps mentioned, and when such programs are effectively owned by recipient government itself and aligned with national productivity growth. The paper does not assume direct causality between aid and economic development. The principles of ownership and alignment are part of the five principles of aid effectiveness adopted in Paris Declaration of 2005. I argue further that effective ownership and alignment require three capacities, including effective negotiating skills, capacity to internalize foreign knowledge, and ability to scale up projects beyond pilot stage. In Japan, and more importantly, in South Korea, these capacities were achieved as a result of investment in education and administrative capacity using aid from the United States. The table shows that Japan and South Korea benefited mainly from two aid providers, the United States and the World Bank. Unlike the current global aid architecture, foreign assistance during the post-war period was less fragmented. There was less issue on harmonization and coordination because only few players were involved. Total U.S. assistance to Japan between 1945 and 1952 was $1.8 billion, which consisted of humanitarian relief, budget support, and more importantly, education and technical assistance. American aid also allowed hundreds of Japanese students to go to the United States and facilitated exchange of visits of U.S. consultants and Japanese experts during U.S. occupation. Japan became a World Bank member country in 1953. At certain period, Japan was the bank's second largest borrower after India. Japan borrowed a total of $862.9 million between 1953 and 1966 for 31 projects. These borrowings coincided with the implementation of first and second five-year development plans that sought to improve national productivity and industrial rationalization. In the table is a summary of the two World Bank projects in Japan. The Aichi Water Canal was originally aimed at developing irrigation for farmers in Chita Peninsula and nearby areas. What is interesting about this project is that the World Bank recommended an American consulting firm to supervise the construction of a dam. The concept of a consultant firm was new at that time in Japan. A study noted that Japanese engineers were amazed at the modern way by which the American consulting firm designed the project in the U.S. using only maps and technical data of the project site sent from Japan. After the project was completed, some Japanese engineers who were involved in the construction established the first ever Japanese construction consulting firm in 1962. Today, large construction firms have their own affiliated consulting firms, and many of them have participated in Japanese ODA-funded infrastructure and foreign investment projects around the world. The American consulting firm also introduced a new method of dam construction called rock fill. Prior to the Aichi project, the post-war dam constructions in Japan were concrete archetype. Japanese engineers returned to their respective prefectures after the completion of the Aichi project were instrumental in diffusing the rock fill method of dam construction. A number of rock fill dams were built in Japan thereafter, such as the Miboro and Gozuryu dams. Meanwhile, the main goal of the land reclamation project was to convert three peatlands into arable paddy fields of rice planting, dairy farming, and mixed farming. These peatlands were located in Shinotsu region and Konsen, which are both in Hokkaido, and Kamikita in Aomori Prefecture. These projects were challenging because first, World Bank missions to Japan in 1953 and 1954 recommended that the peatland in Hokkaido should be developed into dairy farming and wheat cultivation instead of rice paddy fields. Second, bulldozers that were imported using World Bank loans were not appropriate for reclamation work. As a result, Japanese engineers had to redesign bulldozers that would not sink in swamps. The project was a catalyst to local production of bulldozers that could be used effectively in peatland reclamation. These are the project sites that I'm referring to in Japan. The Konsen pilot farm, which was intended for dairy farming, was jointly designed by the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries and the local government of Hokkaido. The project involved two processes, first reclamation of peatlands, and then second, inviting farmers to cultivate the reclaimed land. Each farmer chosen was provided with 18.8 hectares of land, 10 cattle to raise, 611,000 yen subsidy, and financing of up to 2.5 million yen. The outcome of the project resulted to increased milk production in Japan. So what valuable lessons can we learn or can be drawn from this experience? From land reclamation project, ownership was shown by lead agencies' insistence that the Shinotsu peatland should be converted to rice paddies, not to dairy farm. The World Bank only agreed after intense negotiation. The project was obviously aligned with the five-year development plan adopted by the Japanese government. And in terms of knowledge transfer and internalization, the Japanese did not only acquire basic operation of imported machines and translated the English manuals to Nihongo. Engineers also redesigned new bulldozers in order to work in swamps. After the completion, the project site became a breeding ground for new ideas in rice and dairy farming, which were adopted by local government and farmers in other areas in Hokkaido. This is called scaling up. Meanwhile, Japanese engineers acquired three things from the Aichi Water Canal project. One is rock fill dam construction technology. Two is new methods in construction. And three, the concept of construction consulting firm. The rock fill dam technology, as I had said, was used in the construction of other dams in Japan. Knowledge diffusion was made possible by Japanese engineers who worked in the project. We go to South Korea. The figure shows that there were only two predominant bilateral donors to South Korea. during the period 1960 to 1993. They were the United States and Japan. South Korea received a total of $4.42 billion between 1945 and 1975. Post-war U.S. assistance can be divided into three successive waves. The start of the third wave of assistance coincided with the end of the Korean War and the founding of the International Cooperation Administration, the precursor to the U.S. Agency for International Development in 1953, or USAID. This batch of assistance to Korea had the most profound impact on the nation's economic transformation starting 1961 under President Park Chung-hee. In a study, 66% of loans between 1948 and 1961 were spent for enhancing administrative capacity, development, and education. Like Japan, Korea also received significant amount of financial assistance from the World Bank. The World Bank funded a total of 128 projects between 1962 and 2001. These loans were mainly spent for infrastructure, investment, two-step loans, and structural adjustment. POSCO, or Pohang Iron and Steel Company, is Korea's largest steel manufacturer. Former President Park Chung-hee made several attempts in building Korea's first integrated steel mill. The first was in 1961, which marked the start of Korea's first five-year development plan. Both the World Bank and the United States rejected Park's request for funding. By mid-1960s, the Korean government pursued a policy of diversifying sources of credit and started negotiating with Japanese government for reparations payments. In 1968, POSCO was established as a state-owned enterprise. 1969, the Japanese government agreed to assist POSCO construct its first integrated steel mill using Japanese technology and reparations payments. The project was completed in 1973, and POSCO started steel production initially with 1.03 ton. In 2000, it became the second largest producer of steel after Nippon Steel. It was also privatized that year. Today, POSCO is one of the largest and competitive producers of steel in the world. So why Japan agreed to provide funding? The motivations that led to such decision were both political and commercial. Politically, it was regarded as a contribution to regional security. Commercially, it was seen as an opportunity to increase plant exports to Korea, at least from the Japanese steelmakers' perspective. So what can be gained from Korea's experience? In terms of ownership and alignment, the development of steel industry was in line with Korea's five-year development plan. Koreans demonstrated effective negotiating skills in convincing Japanese negotiators to fund the project. Apparently, the Koreans were able to internalize Japanese steel technology and on that basis, use it to generate new and more innovative local technology. Research institutes on steel production were also established. To scale up, the main incentive was to make the steel mill profitable. This was done through continuous innovation and research to improve production. After the first integrated steel mill was built, POSCO underwent four phases of expansion, which led to, among others, establishment of Gwangyang Steel Mill. In 1970, the Steel Industry Promotion Act was enacted to assist POSCO and future other Korean steelmakers based on performance. The cases studied here showed that aid implementation should be sequential. Aid must be invested to education and capacity building at early stage of development and moving later to infrastructure and investment projects. The study indicates that capacity for ownership and alignment during economic transition requires strong administrative and educational foundation. A key in making aid effective is the ability of recipient countries to scale up. In the examples discussed, governments would play crucial roles in this process. Nowadays, civil society organizations participate in the aid processes, particularly in the aid delivery. It is time to rethink how they can contribute to scaling up projects beyond the pilot stage. It took years before the international aid community acknowledged the importance of ownership and alignment in aid effectiveness, particularly in 2005 Paris Declaration. This is so because donors pay more attention to their experience than to successful aid recipients' experience. Japan and South Korea have been outliers in the aid discourse. Yes, the amount of aid matters, and so is geo-economic and strategic interests of donors and recipients. The volume of aid that went to these countries was huge compared to most country aid programs today. And finally, the examples shown have demonstrated the importance of harmonization. Both Japan and Korea had borrowed from the U.S. and the World Bank, and in the case of Korea, from Japan. Aid was less fragmented then. With the emerging new donors, coordination and harmonization have become imperative for effectiveness. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. Yes, there was that was the perception of the majority of my respondents who were the expert of their field. I did expert interviewing. I did interview with ministers, politicians, CEOs of different international NGOs, senior officials of donors and consultants and like this. And on the recipient side, supply-driven aid was the most concerning part. And it's a conventional, you say it's a wisdom kind of a thing. It's a very normal thing. It was not, a very illuminating kind of a finding in Pakistan. Everybody feels the same, that it's supply-driven aid. The donors are coming in with their own agendas, and they are, publishing their partnership strategies every 3 years' time, and they won't even allocate you a single penny beyond that stated agenda which they have published in that document. So yes, the perception is there, and it was very strong at the recipient end. But when you ask the donor that this is how the recipients feel in Pakistan, they say, you tell us where should we invest, because there is no inclusive development framework in Pakistan. So they have to have, they say, like I just quote from a respondent from a bilateral donor, I don't name it. He said, if you don't know what to do it, I will tell you how to do it, and I will tell you what to do. So that was the main limitation which was identified in my research. Coming to the lack of capacity, because since this paper is a product of my PhD research, so this is only one part of it. I have published two papers so far. The third paper is on public sector capacity and how this aid policy network and the presence of numerous donors influence these policy processes in Pakistan, and how it influences the capacity of the state to take decisions and implement those decisions in Pakistan. You are very right. If you have met some DMGs, the district management group, these are the top bureaucrats in our civil establishment in Pakistan, and you must have met some senior secretaries and additional secretaries. But my research, which is, as I say, will be coming in next few months, the third paper, my research suggests that as you go down from that top level, there is a serious lack of capacity there. There is a notable shortage of professionals and technocrats in Pakistan, and mainly the decision making as well as the implementation is is taken care by these bureaucrats. So you are right. At one end, if you look at the public policy cycle, so agendas are setting by different actors. The decisions are taken by different set of actors, and implementation is mainly executed by different set of actors. So the main concern is the people who are the street bureaucrats or the implementing agencies
or the contractors and subcontractors, if there are capacity issues on that part, no matter how good, how perfect the policy you have, it will eventually fail because people at the ground may not be able to implement it properly.
Thank you. Suzanne, I found your discussion about Samoa and the Kiribati most stark. So it almost indicates a kind of a past dependency. The country's geography, cultures, history shaped whether they can take advantage of the concept of country ownership. And the Samoa clearly is better placed than Kiribati. So in the case of Kiribati, you talked that one way to, as an entry point, to lift the country's performance is by us sitting at the table to discuss. I was wondering whether that is really the kind of policy solutions that will address this deep-rooted issue.
I think it's a real challenge. Kiribati faces some significant challenges. And I sort of, in referencing that idea of sitting at the table, that was what the intent of the forum is. I couldn't help but reflect that when Kiribati was present at the forum, for a start, it wasn't represented by their senior people or their most senior leader because of tragedies that had happened back in Kiribati. So they were represented by government officials. But it does go, I think, to the quality of the conversation that happens around the forum meetings on an annual basis, which is why I think that the regional framework, which has said that it's going to provide that opportunity for deeper conversations, I raise the question about whether it will be able to do that. But I'm still grappling because there's ideas here around how representative the government is in terms of its ability to meet the issues of the population of Kiribati, but it comes to the point, I think, around scale that you raised and the amount of money. Kiribati is facing some fairly serious challenges, and on one hand, the compact and the aid effectiveness agenda is about promoting different kinds of governance institutions and the quality of those institutions, but the attention of the leadership has been on climate change because it's such a significant issue. And that's been quite deliberate with the intention of giving the Kiribati an opportunity to choose whether they stay or whether they go. So I think that the situation in Kiribati for Kiribati is really, really difficult.
Thank you. Dennis, I think if we flash back 60 years ago, we saw Japan and Korea having loans from the World Bank. Today, Japan is a large donor for ADB. It contributes one-third of the Asian Development Fund. And we forgot that Japan had that kind of days. It was actually receiving aid. For Korea, it's even more staggering. It's received $15.7 billion with 128 projects. You mentioned that these two countries are outliers. We really hope there will be more outliers like this. And you attributed that one factor for success is the very rapid learning, and because of the capacity built by the USAID in education and so on. I was wondering whether that would be the case, because education and the capacity is a stock that would be built in generations. Even there was the war probably undermined a lot of the capacity. But the pre-war capacity and the education, the culture, the entrepreneurship must have played a role. So I'm not sure whether we can directly attribute this kind of rich learning ability to just the post-war aid, sequential aid.
Mm-hmm. I think the pre-war factors can have only an important role in the case of Japan, because Japan's industrialization actually started during the Meiji period, so which is why I did not pick one project that is related to investment, because Japan was actually an industrial power already before the Second World War, and it was just reconstructing its economy. So the better example would be Korea. So I would say that the pre-war factors, the education and the technical competence were achieved by the Japanese society before the Second World War. But in the case of Korea, some scholars would say, you know, that colonialism, Japanese colonialism, played a lot in the social transformation of Korea. But there were also scholars who argue that there are limits to the effects, you know, of Japanese colonialism on particularly on the educational sector, you know, of Korea. So Korea's educational sector actually improved after the Korean War. Only after the Korean War, because lots of money went into that sector, based from the interviews I conducted in Korea and from the data, documentary research I gathered. And aside from the educational sector, ODA was also, foreign aid was used for administrative capacity, in particular training the members of the military, and the military of South Korea had a unique organizational capacity because of the trainings they received from the United States. So I should say that the pre-war factors only played a lot or played an important role in Japan, but not really that much in Korea. And because of this experience, the discourse on Japanese and Korean aid often referred to the experience that they had in the past. So they always go back to experience. So why Japanese and Koreans are spending more on infrastructure is because of the experience that they had in the past. But what I've seen from my study is that we have to start first with the social capacity building before we proceed to infrastructure and investment projects. Because this would allow government to be more effective in implementing those projects and to maximize the benefits. And more importantly, the role of scaling up is really very important. The project may be small scale, but if the government has the ability to scale up, then the outcomes could be extended to the entire society or to the entire country. Thank you.
Thank you. Now the floor is open. Please, do we have somebody to help as well? Yes. So can you please introduce yourself and also indicate who you are addressing the question to?
I'm Nimad Bijan, a fellow of Development Policy Center and a research associate with the University of Oxford. It was a great panel. My first question is from Dr. Khan. In terms of the influence, you mentioned that China has, concerning its aid, has less influence, policy influence, I would call it, while it's a major donor. My question is, does type of aid matter? Because China is very much focused on infrastructure, while, let's say, World Bank is working with or policy actors or policy makers first. And second, in terms of the interactions which you mentioned, how did you measure the interactions, the chart which you had? The second question is from Dennis. Also, I wrote, when I was at the University of Princeton, I wrote a paper on a state building in South Korea and Taiwan, Afghanistan and Iraq, and looking different patterns. Coming to the question which was asked, and also you pointed about the institutional legacy, of course, in terms of education, less was invested on education, but two trends we can track. First, under the Japanese colonial rule in Taiwan and Japan, universal education was promoted, though it was limited. And second, in terms of types of the states, what happened, Korea had a new patrimonial state, but during that period, that state was transformed into a modern or Weberian state, which was crucial for development of South Korea in the upcoming decades. And another factor I would like to hear from you in terms of continuity and discontinuity in South Korea, because what happened after the invasion by the United States, there was continuity in terms of public administration. Even some of the Japanese were called to stay on and work as advisors, although they were not welcomed in South Korea. Thank you.
Thank you, Nematullah. First of all, what defines influence? According to Köppingen and Klein, there are five, they have divided resources into five major groups that actually defines the influence or the power of any actor or a group of actors within a network. These resources are financial resources, production resources, knowledge resources, competencies, and legitimacies. So anyone who has these resources in abundance and in better in quality, and carrying resource in a better shape, may have an advantage over another actor within the network or within a specific game which is going on in that network. Your question was, does time of aid work? Not necessarily. I give you an example. Whenever we had a problem, specifically a geopolitical problem, we find US aid in Pakistan with a huge amount of grant aid, with a huge amount of financial assistance and technical assistance in Pakistan. We had Afghan-Soviet war in the late 90s, in the Cold War thing, and the US aid were pumping in aid and technical assistance, and everything was, humanitarian aid was coming in. As soon as the Cold War ends, in 98-99, something like that, the same US government, the state office, put sanctions on Pakistan, the economic and trade sanctions on Pakistan, under the Pressler Amendment, which was actually passed in 96, but since the war was not ended for next 2-3 years, they hold that amendment with them, and they put sanctions on us as soon as the war was end, and they rolled back their program. Again, they came back after 9/11, again with a lot of money, with a lot of funds and technical assistance, and with a lot of consultants, wandering around the ministries, corridors, and everywhere. But as soon as you see, we are actually experiencing this now, the war on terror almost ends. They have Osama bin Laden, and they have control in Afghanistan, and might be their interests are fulfilled. They are cutting aid every year. It's a very small amount of aid projects which USAID is doing. It was specifically because when I talked to the experts in Pakistan, specifically on the recipient side, people were considering Asian and Gulf bilateral donors more trustworthy than USAID. So that was the main reason. Next, you asked about how I measured the interactions patterns which I showed here. There were two sources. One, there is an economic EAD, Economic Assistance Division under the Ministry of Finance. They maintain the record of all the donors coming in for the meetings and meeting with the ministry and wherever. So they are maintaining that record. There are also records available in the OECD annual report, like how many donor delegations and consultants are going into the country. And I also used an intensive, it was a bit time-taking, but I made several requests. It was a table, a large table with, like, for example, if I was going to a certain development partner, which is a bilateral donor, I was asking them to kindly take how regularly, how frequently, or how rarely you see, you know, other actors in the network. So they just had to take that. So on the basis of that data, verified by the data with the EAD, I came up with this diagram which I showed there. I hope I answered the question.
Okay. Maybe. Yeah. In one of my interviews, a professor from Ewha Women's University said that Koreans in general give high regard to education. So whether or not the Japanese colonial system provided universal education to Koreans, they will still go to the school. And foreign aid from the United States complemented that attitude among Koreans. So which is why American aid really helped produce a society that is based on knowledge and well-informed members of the community. Now, I haven't tackled the organizational evolution of political institutions in Korea, and I'm not quite sure how to answer the continuity-discontinuity issue. But after the Second World War, what we know is that Korea was governed or administered by the U.S. Army, similar to the way Japan was administered by the U.S. Military. And so, as I've said, because of the Cold War, actually there are so many caveats in my paper that I explained that I was not able to present. So because of the Cold War, it was very strategic for the United States to provide assistance to Korea. And part of that assistance went to the Korean military. They were trained to organize, they were trained to manage. And by 1961, the Korean army was the core of the Korean society who could govern Korea. This is the reason why Park Chung-hee was able to get political legitimacy, because Koreans had high regard on the ability of the Korean army to manage the society, given the context, the Cold War context, the Cold War setting.
Thank you. So we have time for one, two more questions. Any more questions?
Hello, Kim Titcombe is my name, independent consultant and researcher. In view of the time, it's just a very short question for Suzanne. I'm wondering how you selected the Pacific Compact as the instrument, can I say, or vehicle for testing your hypothesis on country ownership?
Yes, please. My apologies. The compact was the key forum leaders agreement, and it was, I guess, an opportunity. Today's presentation leads up to my consideration of the role of the broker, the forum secretariat, in negotiating between the forum and countries. So that's really what I was interested in looking at how they engaged around country ownership with the countries. The compact was the regional dimension of a new initiative by largely the Australian and New Zealand governments that began with the Port Moresby Declaration in 2008 and the Partnerships for Development. But the Partnerships for Development were bilateral agreements. So I wanted to add that regional dimension to my work. Yeah.
Thank you, Suzanne. Dr. Khan, you have some comments,
please? I mentioned this in my blog for the development policy. I was listening to Suzanne, and she mentioned about the collective action thing, and I just want to add on that that in my PhD research, what I found is that if you talk to people, if you go to experts, problems are known. So I don't think we need to spend a lot of energy on just finding problem, like what is the problem. Problems are known. The main actual problem is the lack of collective thought and then proper action on those lines. What I find specifically in Pakistan, I know about Pakistan, I don't know about other developing countries. What I found in Pakistan is we don't even have a formal platform where donors and government and local partners and other researchers and experts can come and interact and share their ideas and learn from each other. No, they are working and operating in isolation. And that is the real problem which I found in Pakistan. And I am pursuing this in the government, I am pursuing this, whatever colleagues and friends I have in Pakistan, but there is very less appreciation there. So I just wanted to add this comment, that the main problem I find is the lack of collective thought and the collective action, which Susan like mentioned.
Can I add to that? I think that's one of the things I wanted to tease out. When the forum leaders gathered in Cairns, they were in a relationship where they were sitting alongside their more powerful development partners.
Yeah.
So even though Kiribati had the Oceanscapes policy, you know, it was going to agree with anything that was initiated by one of its more powerful development partners. Who would not?
Yeah.
And I think that's what I found when I went to Kiribati, is that it showed evidence of compliance. You know, this is an ongoing agenda that had been pursued since 1976. There's evidence in the forum of discussions between country officials and development partners over how the money is used. So this meeting took it up a pitch, but it didn't get down to the heart of how it could work and what it was that was really meaningful for the countries, I think. Yeah.
So one follow-up question.
Thank you. Dr. Khan, I really liked your pictograph of all the different, you know, where everyone sat. In light of the earlier plenary session, maybe it's just in the front of my mind, but I noticed the private sector didn't figure anywhere in there. So I wonder if they were to be there, where they would fit. And that's not necessarily a question for now. But I'm also thinking about leadership and country-led priorities, and sort of having country-led priorities is predicated upon country leadership and the ability to articulate what those country priorities are. In my experience, development partners, and Dr. Khan, you recognize this, I think, development partners, donors, are willing to get on board if local governments or host country governments are able to articulate very clearly what they want. And oftentimes donors are sitting there asking each other in country donor working groups, what do you think the local the government wants? How are you guys fitting in? Should we coordinate together? Or are really waiting for governments to be able to tell them how to spend this money? And so I see the certainly the power dynamics in the Pacific, but to build that, I don't know if it's capacity or agency to articulate those goals. In my experience, donors will get in line. And I've seen host country governments say, we don't want this, we do want that. And if you're not willing to spend the money the way we think you ought to spend it, you can take it elsewhere. And donors get right in line generally about it. Anyway, I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I think in the interest of time, probably we can have some more discussions afterwards. Yeah. But I want to summarize, I feel that from South Asia, Pakistan, to the Pacific, Kiribati, Samoa, and unfortunately we did not have time to listen to the stories for Fiji, and then flashback to the year, more than 60 years ago, to Japan and Korea. There is a recurrent theme that country ownership is the result. It's not something we want to do, it will happen. It's almost the policy or the outcome of interventions, not necessarily the instrument. But now that begs the question, what is the instrument? And the level down, what thing came out is country capacity. That will determine whether the aid is a catalyst or countries will become aid dependent. But the capacity itself is also endogenous. That is the difficulty. We can't have a quick fix for capacity. Yeah. And I think we need to continuously search really how we can break this vicious circle to make it a virtuous circle. And look forward to enlightening research in this very important question. Thank you very much. And let's take off the panelists when we're done.
Thank you.